The Triathlon Show 404. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview James Moran. James is the head of nutrition at the Uno X Pro Cycling Team, and we discuss everything related to nutrition within a Pro Tour cycling team today, and of course we also discuss things like how does this apply or how does this not apply to amateur athletes. But before we get into the interview, I have the pleasure to announce that our 2024 training camp in Mallorca is open for registration. By the time that you hear this episode, I might have recorded and published a mini episode just about announcing the camp with a bit more details. So you can look for that episode on the That Triathlon Show feed in whatever app you're using to listen to the podcast, or you can go directly to scientifictriathlon.com, where you can find all the information about the camp under the training camps menu. The dates of the camp are from the 13th to the 20th of April, so it is a bit later than we have done it in previous years, which means better weather security. And for the rest of the details besides the dates, do check out that webpage or email me directly on michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and I will put a direct link to the webpage in the episode description, so you can just click through in your app and read all about the 2024 Mallorca training camp. And thank you to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that help athletes perform at their best with electrolyte and fueling products and with free online tools, education, and a patented sweat test. You can use the free fuel and hydration planner on their website to get a personalized plan for carbohydrate, sodium, and fluid intake. And you can book a free 20-minute video consultation to chat through your plan with the athlete support team. I have used their entire range of products for a long, long time, and I think that they are absolutely brilliant. And you can get 15% off your first order by using the code TTS20 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Form. The Form Smart Swim Goggles give you real-time feedback in your swim training right on the goggle lens, including splits, pace, stroke rate, and heart rate. Form have recently launched a big and important update, which is an integration with Training Peaks, so that workouts written in Training Peaks can automatically sync to the Form app and the goggles. This works even with swims that are just in written form. They don't have to be built in the workout builder in Training Peaks, and that makes life super easy for you or for your coach. You can just load the workout on your goggles, and then you will be guided through it step by step. You can get 15% off the goggles with the code TTS15 on formswim.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, here's the interview with James Moran. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, James. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Thanks for the invitation to have a chat.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Can we start with an introduction? Tell us more about who you are.
Yeah, so my name's James Moran. I'm from the UK, from Manchester. I'm a performance nutritionist and registered dietitian. My current role is working as head of nutrition with Uno X Pro Cycling Team. Before this role, I worked with Ineos Grenadiers cycling team for a few years, British cycling. I was in the English Institute of Sport for a while. And then before that, I was a clinical dietitian. So I worked in the healthcare space in the UK. So working in hospitals in different conditions, mostly with people with type 1 diabetes was my kind of specialist area when I was a clinical dietitian. And the past few years, I've worked mostly with endurance sports, and the past 4 years mostly with road cycling, a little bit with mountain bike and road, but mostly road cycling this past few years.
Well, that's interesting that you started as a clinical dietitian. So how does it work education wise I assume that all dietitians, whether it's related to clinical dietetics or endurance sports or sports dietetics, it's the same basic education, but do you have different focus within that education, or how does it work?
Yeah, it's completely different actually. So the term nutritionist isn't like a protected title, so anybody can call themselves a nutritionist, and people commonly do. The standards now in the UK, we have the Sport and Exercise Nutritionist Register, and they're trying to standardize the training and education and level of sports nutritionists in the UK, but it's still not a protected or regulated title. And dietitian is a protected title in the UK and Australia and a few other countries, like a physiotherapist. So you have to have done a set amount of clinical hours of practice where you supervised and monitored and trained. And then you work usually for 1 or 2 years in clinical, like hospital settings. So it's very different training and background. And then I worked in the clinical space for a long time. And then I did a master's kind of later on in my career in sports nutrition to allow me to get some of the skills and knowledge that I was maybe missing from the sports space. But yeah, they're quite different how they're trained and approached.
Yeah, all right. Was that something that you were always planning on doing to at some point go into sports nutrition and and take that master's degree, or did it come up later?
No, it was always the intention. I always knew I wanted to work in sport. I originally, when I was 17, 18, thought I wanted to be a physiotherapist. That was my kind. I knew I wanted to be like an athlete support personnel. I knew I was never going to be gifted enough to be an athlete. I grew up playing team sports, football, rugby, not really endurance sports. And then when I was 18, I did a sports science degree. So from 18 to 21, sport and exercise science degree. And at that time, there wasn't really a clear pathway to then becoming a sports nutritionist. This was in the early 2000s. So it was still a kind of new profession as such. So at that time, I decided to kind of go down the clinical route and hopefully pick up bits of work and experience in sports nutrition. And then that didn't really happen. I kind of managed to get a good career in the health system, helped out some friends and, you know, semi-professional athletes. And then it was a chance meeting at a conference. I was speaking about type 1 diabetes and exercise. And James Morton, Professor James Morton, who was working at Team Sky at the time, was also presenting at this conference. And we got talking and I kind of told him where I was up to in my career. And it's him that kind of encouraged me to go and study a master's with him and Graham Close at Liverpool, John Moores. So yeah, that was that. And I kind of went all in, decided that I was going to fully invest and live like a student for a year and live off my wife's salary with the main aim of becoming a sports nutritionist at the end of it. So it's a kind of quite a long journey to get to where I am today, to working in sports nutrition.
Mm. Yeah. And if we discuss what you're doing today with UnoX, what are your roles and responsibilities specifically?
Yeah, so my title is Head of Nutrition, and the short answer is I oversee, you know, everything to do with what the riders eat and drink at home and the training, on training camps and on races. And what that means in practical terms is on races, we have a team of carers, we have a team of performance chefs and a kitchen truck. So I'm kind of responsible for ensuring the quality and the structures of the things that they're doing with providing food for the riders in race situations. We have a women's team nutritionist, Hannah Mayo. So I kind of oversee her a little bit. She's responsible for our women's team, but I kind of, yeah, help her out in the background. And then we have a development team as well, which we focus mostly on education for those guys in the development team, nutrition education. Yeah, so a lot of working with nutrition partners. We're partnered with Morton, so we do a lot of work with them with product development and new things like that. And then working with other companies that we use as well. Everything to do with nutrition, food, drink, and performance, really.
What would you say? What is the most challenging part of your job, and two, what is the most interesting or fun part, the part that you enjoy the most?
The most challenging part, and when I speak to colleagues of mine that work in football, for example, is this week we have the Tour of Denmark and Arctic Race of Norway, plus some under 23 races going on. So essentially I need to be across three races in three different countries with three different lineups, with three different sets of staff, and make sure that the riders, the staff are all clear on what they need to do with with feeding, the weather conditions, what the riders need to do with their individual nutrition each day, what nutrition products needs to be in each race for each group of riders. So it's the logistics, and almost having to split yourself in three places at one time is probably the most challenging. We have got some systems in place that help with that, and we're trying to build more and more systems so it's more automated and less manual input and manual labor on my part to make sure that all of those things are done. So that's probably the most challenging and probably the most frustrating part of my job. Hopefully in time we'll be able to bring on more nutrition staff as well into the team to help me a little bit with some of that stuff. And then the fun part for me is the big races like the Tour de France, where it's a 21 day puzzle, as well as the months leading up to that race of you know, your eight riders, making sure that they're healthy, that their body composition's been optimized, that they've had all the support they need around gut health, around competing at altitude, competing in the heat. And then in that Tour de France, where each day is slightly different, each day has different demands from weather, altitude, meters, distance, all of those things together, that's the fun part for me, the big challenge that I really enjoy.
Are you present there? Are you with the team at those big races like the Tour?
Yeah. So for the Tour that we've just done, I was there for the full month. So it's a long time away from the family, but it's the same for everybody on that. But I think it's important because a lot of what I do with the team around the data that I get, I can capture a lot of that from home and remotely. But I think sometimes you miss the context of the data. You know, if you just get looking at their kind of the power meter and the heart rate and all the other things and the nutrition data, but you're not actually speaking with the riders and observing the riders and speaking with the race directors to understand, no, actually, this is going to be the demands tomorrow and these are going to be the tactics. I think you can miss that extra layer of input. And as well, being on those races, it just enables me to make sure that the riders are getting exactly what we've prescribed nutritionally when they need it. So a big part of my role in the last Tour de France was I was on the bus after the stage to the finish. And a big part of that was to make sure that the recovery protocols that we prescribed were followed, because commonly food and the recovery products are left there. But from my experience, when riders are fatigued, stressed, they might not take all of the recovery food, or on a busy bus where the staff come in and going and the bus is moving, riders might just miss parts of that recovery. So a big focus for me was in those first 4 hours after the races, was making sure that each of the units of recovery that we were prescribing, that they were getting. And if they were struggling, then I could find alternatives. I think that helped keep the riders healthy and recovering each day. I think it would have been easy to overlook that if I wasn't there, perhaps.
Yeah. So let's go into an overview of how you think about nutrition within the context of pro cycling for racing, training, and day-to-day. So maybe we start with racing. Just give us an overview of what you think is important there.
Yeah, for me, the racing is the kind of easier part of, because, you know, I just think it's the riders start to have routines and they know how to adjust things here and there. Everything's done for them. We have a chef, we have the carers, the food's provided. So I think a lot of the racing stuff generally is probably easier than training. But we always start off with energy balance. So we would predict the energy demands of that individual stage. And then we would start with a nutrition plan based on those assumptions of the energy demands of that stage and the individual rider. And then we would work backwards and devise a plan based on that. And then after the stage, if the energy demands had been significantly higher or lower, then we would adjust for the rest of the day to make sure that they were in energy balance for those days. So we all would start off on a spreadsheet, or, you know, as a numbers-based exercise. First of all, riders have individual preferences in races, like what products they like, what drink combinations, what gel combinations, whether they prefer more solids, whether they prefer more semi-solids. So I would always give like an overview of recommendations for a particular stage and then allow the rider to customize, okay, if I need to hit this amount of carbohydrates per hour, these are the foods that I think I would like to use for that. And then we can have a conversation around that. With the breakfast, we always give a recommendation based on the energy demands for that day. And breakfast typically on a race consists of rice, overnight oats, smoothies, breads, fruit, and then eggs and yogurt for protein. So it's a standard kind of breakfast that they would have at home. Just the timing and the volume might differ a little bit. Some riders and for some stages.
How big would the breakfast be roughly? What are you shooting for calorie intake and carbohydrate intake?
Yes, we tend to base it off grams per kilogram of carbohydrate. So a standard breakfast around racing within our team is usually around two grams per kilo of carbohydrate. For a bigger day, we would just add an extra unit or two onto that. So we'd add some extra pancakes or some banana bread or a few extra glasses of smoothie onto that. But the base breakfast tends to be pretty consistent with what they like to eat most days. For some of, you know, if we were doing a big mountain block or if we were trying to, if we were being conscious about body mass, we would possibly do like more low fiber, low residue options, more rice, less kind of high fiber foods, less oats and things like that. But again, you can't do that every day for 21 days because you either crack mentally or riders end up constipated. So we try and periodize fiber intakes around racing so that we know when it's flatter days or days when the riders aren't going to need to fuel in an extreme amount, then we try and encourage them to get more fiber, more fruits, more vegetables. Whereas a day that's going to be really intensive or with lots of a big mountain day, then it makes sense to prioritize the amount of carbohydrate of the meal rather than, you know, adding bits of fiber. So we try and periodize the fiber as well as everything else. And then in the race, like I say, that will depend on the demands of the race. I will give them a guide based on how we think the stage will go. But we always say to fuel for the kind of worst case scenario. It's pointless really under fueling and then crosswinds come and then somebody's caught out because they've really under fueled. So it's a bit of a balance. And again, it's individual. Some riders don't like to fuel like crazy amounts, and it's not something we push for every stage and every race. And when I say crazy amounts, you know, the 120, 130, 140 grams of carbohydrate per hour. The approach that we would typically use is probably similar to Tim Podlegar that you've had on the show before. And I think we share quite a lot of similar philosophies on that. We would maybe start off in the first few hours of a stage around 80 grams per hour and progressively increase through the stage. Typically, the average intakes would be around 80 to 100 grams per hour for most guys for most stages. And then after the stage, we have quite a strict recovery protocol to try and maximize glycogen resynthesis and recovery after a stage. So in the first 3 to 4 hours, we try and hit around 3 grams of carbohydrate per kilogram of body mass for a standard stage. And that would typically be things like Haribo and candy, and as they cross the finish line, some riders will have Fanta if they like it, and then they'll get back to the bus. They will have a recovery shake with protein and dual source carbohydrate. Sometimes more Haribo, depending on how demanding the stage has been. They'll have a shower and then they'll have a solid meal, usually a rice or pasta-based dish, which has been weighed out for their body mass and energy expenditure. And then if it's been a crazy hard stage and there's another hard stage to follow, we'll add on extra smoothies and extra Haribo or extra cake, which have all been portioned and calculated. So it sounds quite random how I describe that to you. But when I have 8 riders on a bus, I know exactly how many pieces of cake they need to have to hit their targets, or how much smoothie, 250 ml smoothie, the the Haribo is portioned out, so we can then ensure, okay, we've hit these targets that we're aiming for. And then they get back to the hotel, they'll have a massage, some treatment, and then they sit down for dinner. And in that time from finishing the stage to dinner, I would then give them a plan for what they need to have for dinner, which would usually center around the carbohydrate portions and amounts that they need for dinner. The meals that we cook are mostly fairly low fat anyway, and the protein portions are usually controlled in a way that we don't want riders to eat excessive amount of protein. So then all that's left then is to understand how much rice, pasta, noodles, bread, dessert, juice and things like that they need to have with their dinner so that they're ready for the next day. So that's the kind of how we approach it. Some riders will record every single thing they eat in a race. So I'm giving them constant feedback and adjusting. Other riders, they will get a plan and they will kind of let me know if they've gone over or under that plan. Other riders will get a plan and I don't really hear much back other than they've had a plan and they've given me a thumbs up. So we try and individualize it because, you know, some riders find it highly stressful to be recording everything that they're eating. And I think for riders that maybe it tends to be the riders that are climbers or that weight is more of a component of their performance, they tend to be a bit more wanting more detail in that kind of area so that they're kind of sure that they're getting enough, but not too much and not too little.
When you speak about protein, what would you say is the grams per kilogram of protein that they're getting in during a stage race like the Tour?
Yeah, I think if you're not careful, it can go very high. We would have it around 2 to 2.5 grams per kilo, which is, yeah, it's higher than what we'd see in a lot of the literature. But I think the thing that I find is just the sheer volume of food that the riders are eating. You know, the amounts of pasta and bread that they're eating, you're getting a lot of protein just from those foods alone. You know, and then if you're having 150 grams of chicken or fish, a skier yogurt here and there, it can quickly run out of control, and it's all calories at the end of the day. So the way I approach it is we have a budget of energy, of calories, and I want to maximize the amount of carbohydrate that's in that budget. Protein and fat should usually take care of themselves if we're careful. But I have seen riders in the past way over consuming protein and probably then either going over their energy balance and gaining weight, or not quite eating enough carbohydrate and being slightly under their energy balance and then under fueling. So it's something we focus on a lot, is getting your carbohydrates exactly where they need to be, then the protein, and then the fat.
And when you talk about starting from the energy balance side of things, is that, do you estimate and then confirm the energy requirements for the day based on, is the average power data for the stage enough to get an adequate estimate of the calories burned throughout the race? And then and do you add that to some resting metabolic rate, or how does that work?
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that. And then obviously that's quite a crude way of approaching it, but it's just a way of starting off with a figure, with a value. And then if somebody's after the stage, the energy prediction can be quite close, but somebody's gone really, really deep in the final, or somebody has been in the breakaway all day, so then the energy is quite a lot higher. So then we always have to adjust based on that, because, for example, you can deplete quite a lot of glycogen by riding really hard for a short space of time. You can also deplete glycogen riding for 6 hours. The energy expenditure of those two durations would be quite different, but the amount of carbohydrate that's been used would be high. So we have to take that into account, like the relative intensity as well for that. So it's always somewhere to start, but I'm very mindful of, you can't rely 100% on data like that. You have to speak to the riders as well and see how they felt, see how they fueled in the race, understand the objectives of the next day as well. So it just starts as a, instead of having a really, really wide, you know, range of what the number could be, it just brings us a bit closer, and then we refine after the stage. One of the problems I have with like apps and softwares that do a lot of this, you the very black box. So they kind of, it's very much numbers in, numbers out, eat this very structured intake. And I think without a nutritionist or somebody who understands that data and understands the rider or the athlete, then you can be quite a lot out, because we know that food can vary a lot, you know, depending on what database is used. You know, pasta can range. The power data might be off, you know, depending on how accurate the power meter is. So it's all of those things, heat, altitude. So you have to be able to make adjustments here and there for all of those things along the way, rather than just using, oh, the spreadsheet tells me 3,500 kilojoules. Well, that's exactly how much I'm going to feed them, and not a calorie or a gram more or less. I think it can be quite dangerous if you use that approach too much.
Yeah, no, 100%. In a hypothetical scenario where the riders were left to their own devices and they had access to all of the food that they could imagine, but in a race like the Tour, but you weren't there and nobody else was there to guide them and help them with how to eat, do you think that they would get it mostly right, or would there be a tendency to underfuel or overfuel or not getting enough carbs, or what would happen?
That's a good question, and I think one of the approaches we do, like I said at the outset, because there's only me in the men's pro team and we might have three races going on at all times, a lot of the races, there's not a nutritionist there. And I quite like that sometimes they're left to almost calibrate themselves and sense check, okay, James isn't here, but yeah, I think this is all right. And to keep that, they're almost like a rider, you know, if their power meter breaks, they should still be able to have an understanding of yeah, what's what. I think the big concern in the Tour de France is just the fatigue, which typically affects people's appetite negatively. They start to undereat, you know, after day 10, 11. They start to just get emotionally drained. They start to get bored of eating food. And I think not having me there to just almost tap them on the shoulder and say, you know, you've not eaten enough there. Let's get, you know, what's the problem, and get a bit more. I think over 3 weeks, that gap can widen and you see riders then just not recovering as well and not quite eating enough, I would suspect, rather than the opposite.
Yeah, that's interesting. So maybe we move on to fueling the training then, the training sessions specifically, and then after that we tackle the day-to-day nutrition, or if you want to tackle them simultaneously, then that's also fine, I think.
Yeah, I think tackle them together, because, you know, if riders aren't racing, they're either training or they're recovering. So it's kind of one feeds into the other. And again, we would start with energy balance, but I try not to be overly prescriptive with riders when they're in the home setting, unless we're working on something for a focused period. Because I have 30 riders in the men's pro team, and I think trying to be prescriptive with what they should eat each day is just not possible or necessary. Whereas if a rider was working on optimizing body composition, or we were doing a period of monitoring and educating, then that's slightly different. My approach is to do these short interventions with riders, give them skills, give them understanding, let them know the framework to operate in, and then step back and let them, you know, work with their nutrition at home, and then use me as an almost a consultant, like a coach, to check in and say, okay, I've done this, what do you think? And that it works a bit more organically that way. A lot of what we focus on is kind of giving them the skills at home to be able to cook and plan meals and all of the practical things that's quite hard to quantify and easy to overlook. But it's something that we work a lot on with the riders, making sure that the kind of nutrition quality is good as well at home, so that they're eating lots of fruits and vegetables in the home setting. Because when it comes to racing, the races we have a chef, we can control fruits and vegetables, making sure they're getting good quality at the right times. Whereas if they're staying in a hotel where we haven't got the chef, the menu is quite often lacking in nutrients. So when they're at home, we have a big push on something called Eat the Rainbow, where we try and encourage them to get as many different colors into the diet as possible. Typically I've found working with Norwegian athletes or Norwegian cyclists that they don't have the same culture of fruit and vegetable intakes as maybe working with athletes from the Mediterranean or athletes that live in warmer environments. And I guess that's just historical over time. I mean, you might be able to share similar insights from Finland, but I guess, you know, tropical fruits and vegetables are probably expensive, or if they're not in season, that they're maybe not as available. So we do a lot of things around frozen vegetables, frozen fruit, trying to incorporate those into the diet as well. Yeah, in terms of like the training side of things, again, some of the energy demands of training can actually be higher than some of the stages that the race in. So it's thinking about what's the demands of that day in terms of calories, carbohydrate, how hard's the session going to be, and getting the rider to come up with their own nutrition plan, which then I would look over and tweak as they need to. For concentrated blocks like altitude camps, or like I said, if we're working with a rider that's trying to optimize something for a particular race, then it would be a much more detailed one-to-one approach. But typically when I joined the team, the big things that I was seeing with the UNOX riders was they're eating way too little carbohydrate on hard training days. They were using training to almost help with weight management, but under fueling training. And then I was seeing a lot of riders overeating off the bike because they were so hungry and depleted all the time. And I was seeing massive intakes of protein and meat. When I first joined the team, I was kind of quite shocked about how much meat and protein that riders were ingesting compared to how much carbohydrate they were eating. And that's something we've slowly changed bit by bit. But I can remember being sat on my first training camp with them, and I was just staggered about how much meat riders were coming back from the buffet with. And I knew there was a 5-hour ride the next day with intervals, and riders were eating next to no carbohydrate. And it was just, it kind of blew my mind a little bit. So bit by bit, we've worked a lot on that with riders now. And it's become almost like a joke when riders reflect back on how their eating patterns in the past.
Do you have any recollection of like data where they're having 4 or 5 grams per kilo body weight carbohydrates back then, or and now they're up to 8 to 10, 10 to 12 for those harder training days, training camps, or?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I have riders now a rider last week who was around 14 grams per kilogram of carbohydrate on a training day, and he was almost laughing at it. He said, you know, he would have been scared to eat that much a few years ago, but he now knows how better his training is, how much, you know, he's improving, how much more stable his weight is as well. We don't see those massive weight fluctuations because riders are under fueling, and then as soon as their body, you know, is exposed to high carbohydrate intakes, they just kind of swell up and retain all of this glycogen and fluid, whereas we see much less big fluctuations now in weight, and riders are much more stable and consistent day to day, which is good. Which is kind of my main aim as nutritionist with the team, to support their training consistency, so that they're able to complete the work that the coaches are prescribing, you know, that they're able to get through a training block, that they're not having one really good day where the numbers are great and then 3 days where they can't do the same again. It's about the consistency with training. And I'm a big advocate of training consistency should, you know, be supported by nutrition consistency.
And would the fueling within the sessions be similar to what you described for the races, maybe starting at still at consuming carbohydrates, but doing a bit more later in a longer session, like you said, but averaging out to 80 to 100 more or less? Or is there any difference between the training, fueling and racing if we're looking at least a harder training day?
Yeah, if it's a harder training day, it's different from a logistics point of view. If you think in a race, we have a car that's behind them all the time, giving them extra drinks. We have people by the roadside giving them extra drinks. So that side of things can be a bit more tricky to manage. But for a highly demanding session, yes, we would still be, you know, looking somewhere around 80 to 100 grams of carbohydrate per hour, but probably not for the full session, probably around the leading into and the block of work, you know, if they're doing race-like intervals. But then the first hour and maybe even the last hour of the session where they're just doing easy riding, then we will scale the fueling right back in those kind of sessions. And for general endurance riding as well, we'll drop the carbohydrate intakes quite a bit lower than that in those sessions, because we're still wanting to, you know, every session doesn't need to be like a super extreme carbohydrate session, because that's not demanded by that session. So it's usually like a more moderate approach on those kind of sessions. We typically don't do kind of fasted training, and I do believe that this is gone a lot out of fashion in the pro peloton as well. I think some riders may do it here and there, but especially with our riders being younger, I think riders get much more bang for the buck from being able to complete the work, you know, each day and layering on these training sessions instead of doing a low carbohydrate or a low glycogen session, having a higher rate of fat oxidation from that session, but then struggling to recover for the next few days. Maybe with riders when they're older and in the 30s, and you know, they've maximized all of those other things, there might be merit in the off season or early season to be doing some of those sessions. But with our riders, my big aim is to help them cope with the demands of training and to stay healthy. So we don't really do much low carb training, if any, with our guys.
Yeah. So when you talk about more moderate carbohydrate intakes in those regular endurance rides, what is that in grams per hour roughly?
Yeah, it'd be more like between 30 to 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour on some of those sessions, you know. And again, we will adjust that. So if we're on a training camp in Spain, a session might be prescribed as, you know, zone one, zone two, but you're in a group of 10 guys, each feeling a bit fresh. People start pushing the pace and the session actually becomes a zone three ride. So we always kind of would say in those kind of rides, yeah, maybe more like a 60 grams per hour, because it's actually different to what's prescribed. If someone's training alone with like one or two of their teammates at home and it's a real controlled session, then that might be more like 40 grams of carbohydrate per hour. So they would adjust it themselves. I give them framework and guides to work within, and then they adjust that based on what they're trying to achieve. The one thing we try not to do though is use training as a means of losing weight, like the old fashioned, you know, just not eating on rides and hoping that creates a bigger calorie deficit. I think just by the amount of work these guys are doing, it's easy to create a calorie deficit by being organized and well planned without coming back from each training session seeing stars. And then usually what happens is they'll hold off and hold off, but then at some point they will break and they will eat way, way too much and the wrong things, and weight can be really up and down then. So we try and be more kind of moderate and in the middle and consistent.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing we talked about a bit over email is putting a big focus on using nutrition as a way to optimize health and be a support to training. And you've touched on several things already with eating the rainbow and so on, and consistency within nutrition. But is there anything else that you would like to talk about or mention as in regard to nutrition having this role?
Yeah, I mean, I can send you the it's like almost like a pyramid that we use within our coaches and riders, and at the it's an upside down pyramid. But the headline is, you know, we work on nutrition to support training consistency. So are they getting enough total calories and carbohydrate to support training consistency? And we find that then that feeds in quite well to nutrition to support health. You know, if they're able to meet their energy demands, if they've got good carbohydrate availability, then that can go a big way to supporting health. You know, if they're having enough fuel to support their immune system and they're having enough fuel to support a training, then we can typically see training progression and the rider, you know, is less prone to picking up upper respiratory tract infections and, you know, just small illnesses here and there. The next layer after that, then we look at optimizing race nutrition. So it's getting those two in place first, and then we would look at some of the things we've said about race fueling, training the gut, all those kind of things. And then what we would come after, if once those three are kind of in line and somebody's experienced and stable and ticking the boxes with that, that's when we might start to look at optimizing body composition for some individuals. The reason I wanted to outline that was in some teams, in some organization, it would start maybe the opposite. It's like, oh, well, this rider's weight is this and it should be this. It should be, you know, 5 kilos lower because we think if they can be there, their power to mass will be this and blah, blah, blah. Whereas we come at it differently. It's about building the engine, making them robust, making them healthy, making them consistent and able to execute what they need to with their nutrition in race. Then we would look at body composition optimization. So with the young development riders, we don't do any monitoring of body composition. And then when riders join our team as like a first year professional, we just capture body composition throughout the season, but not to do anything with it, just to see what their seasonal variation is. Starting to work with the rider and the coach to see long term, we think this rider may benefit from being at this kind of weight, but understanding that if a rider's 20 or 21, they've still got quite a long way to go in terms of maturation, how their body composition is distributed, and things like that. So it's done much more holistically rather than getting a 20-year-old guy and saying, oh, he's 62 kilos now, but if we could get him to 58 kilos, he'll be a great rider. And in the short term, that might be true, but in the long term, that can do a lot of damage and create a lot of, the rider starts to become overly focused on weight and body composition. And, you know, weight is a key factor in cycling, but it's not the only factor. And that's the thing we always come back to when we're talking about health. If we can get the rider healthy and consistent, then the other things start to fall in place and we can refine later on.
Yeah, no, that's a nice segue to one thing that I wanted to talk about as well, which was in, I think in Velo before the tour, it was a case study about one of your riders, Jonas Abrahamsen, who had over time, I can't remember how many years, but I think this was several years, but he had gained something like 20 kilos from his junior or very early senior or under 23 days to now. And improved his performance significantly by consciously putting on weight. So I know that this is maybe not something that you can go into too much detail on that specific case study, but if there's something you want to say about that, then feel free. But just in general, can you talk about the concept of gaining weight as a means to improve cycling performance overall?
Yeah. So I obviously can't go into too much detail about Jonas, but I can speak a little bit because he's spoken a lot to the media and there's been a lot of articles that he shared. But when I first joined Uno X, Jonas was actually the very first rider I did a one-to-one consultation with. And we did the Tour de France together this summer. And it was, you know, when we sat down, we reflected on, you know, his journey this past few years. And when I joined the team, he was transitioning. He'd been trying to be a climber and he'd by his own admission been really, really weight focused, and, you know, had some good days, but then some days where he wasn't able to deliver what the coaches thought he was capable of. And when I joined the team, he'd already gained some weight. And then we sat down and he kind of said, you know, talked to me a little bit about this and said how he thinks he could be more explosive as a rider and he'd like my support to maybe help to gain some weight and make him stronger. And then fast forward to the Tour de France 2023 and he was, you know, I think 10 or 12 kilograms heavier than that conversation we had in December 2019. So that's a significant amount. But if you just look at if he'd have carried on that path of being overly weight focused, he probably wouldn't be a professional cyclist now. If he was a professional cyclist, he wouldn't have ridden the Tour de France this year. Whereas now he's transitioned into being one of our strong, you know, sprint lead out guys, breakaway guys, a classics guy. And it was almost like he was trying to make himself into a kind of rider that didn't suit his natural attributes. And now he's a real powerful, strong guy. And seeing him in the Tour de France every morning at breakfast, coming into the breakfast room, cracking jokes and, you know, laughing and in the breakaway, in the lots of stages and finished third on a long, hard breakaway stage. So yeah, for him, it was the right thing to do. And I think it just comes back to riders will often look at, young riders will often look at the guys who win the Tour de France and you know, to be a GC rider in the Tour de France, weight is a factor in performance. The ability to, you know, climb high mountain passes, weight plays a part in that, power to weight ratio does. But a lot of these young riders will never be a GC rider in the Tour de France. They might actually not be a GC rider in any race. And then you start to dig down into what kind of rider are you? What are your attributes? What does your coach see for you? What do you see for you? And then you can start to dig down into what are you like physically? When I first joined Uno X, having worked with different cyclists and different cycling teams, I was struck by just how athletic all of the riders were. It felt like I was working with a team of athletes rather than a team of cyclists. And I think, you know, the riders all do cross-country skiing and hiking, and they're just more active. So because of that, their physiques are slightly different. They're, you know, stronger, more rounded as athletes. So, and some of the riders that successful for their role as a sprinter or a hardy kind of rider. So it's about trying to understand the kind of rider and how much does body composition and weight play a part in their success, and to what, how much should it be emphasized or not? You know, if somebody is an out and out climber and they're targeting these long climbs, then obviously we need to optimize that. It becomes more important than for somebody who's more important to perform over flat or rolling terrain. So it's just about individualizing body composition for different riders, not having squad norms. You need to be this sum of 8 skin folds, or you need to be that. It's about, okay, what's your baseline? What's your genetics like? What are your family like? What kind of rider are you? What age are you? You know, the body composition you are now might be fine for now, but in 5 years it could be different. We have got some riders who've just come into the pro team this year, and we are working on actually gaining weight because they've probably underfueled as a junior and under 23 because of this perception they need to be lighter or skinnier. And then they've probably suppressed a lot of the explosivity and, you know, sprint capabilities that they might have. So it's quite an exciting journey when you're working with these young guys who are 20 to 23 to actually say, no, let's just optimize your nutrition and see where your body composition naturally lands. And then we can maybe refine it one way or another, depending on coach, you, your health and all those kind of things.
Do I remember right from reading that one of those articles as well about Jonas that he actually got taller when he started working on putting on weight in his early 20s maybe, or very late teens?
Yeah, no, he was in his early 20s. Yeah, that happened. And yeah, my take on that is, you know, you've probably had people on speaking about low energy availability and you know, REDS and things like that. I think in sometimes people can almost suppress a lot of the kind of hormones around puberty and growth hormone and testosterone. And then with good nutrition and appropriate load managing, then the body almost kicks back. It's almost like a spring that's been kind of squeezed for a long time. And then when it's allowed to expand and be released, it kicks back quite a lot. I think a lot of athletes and riders aren't always lucky, and when they realize that, oh, actually I've been training too hard and not eating enough, it's usually when there's a health issue, and the health issue is usually, you know, a bone issue or a stress fracture, or with female athletes, issues with the menstrual cycle or fertility. And quite often it can be too late, and the damage can have been done by there. So that's why we work a lot with our younger guys to emphasize these things.
Yeah, it's something I've heard about at least one world-class triathlete. It's not in the public domain or anything, but that had the same thing with, at one point in his late teens, like, or early 20s, starting to grow again after having stopped growing in his teens at some point, which, yeah, at a later point than you would expect, just based on changes in nutrition that happened at that point, and probably for the same reasons that you outlined there. But in terms of gaining weight and cycling performance, what are, for Jonas, for example, in terms of power improvement, do you have quantitative data on like how much his power improved or things like that?
I've not got that data in front of me. I do remember like the first probably 6 to 12 months was quite hard for him because his body mass obviously went up quicker than his kind of power numbers and his performances on the bike. And then psychologically, it took a lot of reassurance and work from the coach that things were going to improve. But I think in that initial phase, you're seeing your power to mass getting worse because your power isn't increasing really quick, but your weight is. So I think that can be quite challenging for some individuals. And especially, you know, if somebody's on a short contract with a team and hasn't got, they're quite insecure about things, you can see why that would be really difficult to manage. I think as well with younger riders, it's, for me, it's about, I've said it lots of time, but getting the work done, you know, building that engine. If a rider was a certain weight at 20 and they lost 6 kilos, that's not going to make them a Tour de France winner just because they're the same weight as somebody who's won the Tour de France. They need to build that engine, be robust, you know, have that durability. It's more than just, oh, if I look like Chris Froome or, you know, Jonas Vingegaard, then I'll win the Tour de France. it's understanding that it's the years and years of training and layering on that side of things that enables somebody to be a high performer, not just the weight. The weight is part of it, but it's not the main part of it.
Do you think that is something that is like a lot due to basically genetics, like that a few riders have the ability to get to a certain like body composition and be really light and still have the power to be a Tour de France winner, but for a lot of riders it's just, as you say, it's you have to work with the individual in front of you and their attributes and their what they are naturally suited to being, and it's just something that for most riders is not possible to achieve no matter if they do all things right because of basic genetics. Or what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, genetics has a massive part to play. There's that saying, isn't it, like, choose your parents wisely. So some riders will naturally be able to get to, you know, a very lean or a desirable body composition for them without too much work. Other riders can get there, but it's a lot of work and it takes its toll. Other riders can get to the body composition, but then they're not able to produce the numbers needed at that body composition. And it's a tricky one because some riders really need to push to find out where that set point is. You know, I can use my judgment and experience and work with the rider and say, okay, I think this is probably a good point that we aim for, but riders will usually try and push past that. And it's only then when the rider then realizes that they've gone too far, that then they actually say, okay, yeah, you were right. And maybe this is a more sustainable, achievable place to be. But understanding as well, like the body composition and weight for performing at the Tour de France isn't the same body composition and weight that somebody should be in March or January or December. And I think that's something that people often get wrong as well, trying to do too much too soon. Some of our riders, you know, the more climbing riders we had in our squad, we had, you know, weight and skinfold targets that we were trying to get them to for the Tour de France. And we really stepped down. So even from the Dauphiné, the training camp they had after it, the tour, we stepped it down from there. Whereas if they'd been at that weight in March, April, they might have thought great and they might have performed well in March and April, but they would have either got sick or they wouldn't have been able to hold it until the Tour de France. So it's about understanding that as well, periodizing and peaking weight and body composition for exactly where it needs to, not trying to be as skinny as possible in December and then spending all winter with inconsistent training because your immune system's so stressed.
And with those riders, we did then after the tour put on a few kilos again to basically strengthen the immune system and be able to support training better again.
Yeah, and it happens naturally. There's not like a big intervention that's needed from me. I think mentally, the lead in, you know, to the Tour de France, and especially the guys on our team, it was 7 of the 8. It was their first Tour de France. So mentally, you know, there's a big toll just preparing and being in the tour. So I think just taking the foot off the gas for a few weeks afterwards, I think people will naturally see a drift up in weight and body composition. And yeah, it's not something we really need to stress about. We're quite lucky in our program that we don't have a world tour program yet. So we you know, we had some riders who have to perform for worlds, and then we have races now starting next week in September. So it's not like we have to do the welter or things like that. So we can allow this kind of, I like the weight and body composition to peak and then drift up a little bit and then step back down again. And same in the off season, riders are often set targets for, you know, gaining weight in the off season to almost reset the system. I think that's good from a mental point of view, but also from a hormonal and longevity point of view, rather than trying to stay at race weight, you know, all year. So it's something we actually like riders to come to December camp, you know, within reason, heavier than when we saw them in October at our end of season camp.
What would be an example of the weight of a more climbing type rider in your team, their weight in at the December training camp versus at the tour?
Yeah, I mean, it's all relative. So the bigger guys will always see a bigger absolute change. Percentage-wise, it's, you know, probably between 3 and 5%. Typically, a climber might be, yeah, 2 kilos heavier. So it's not a massive amount, but it's usually enough. And some riders will come back and they'll say, you know, I had 2 weeks, I just ate pizza and did what I wanted, and my weight, yeah, drifted up 2 kilos, but then I started training and it's maybe like a kilo, kilo and a half now above Tour de France weight. So it's not a huge amount, but I think, yeah, having some weight gain is advantageous, both mentally and physically.
Mm. And you said that, yeah, with your climbing type athletes, you do have those targets, but with athletes that have other roles that are more, yeah, lead out people or breakaway athletes or just domestiques in general, do you have some targets for all of them for something like the tour, or are there a lot of athletes that they're basically fine with without having a big focus on what their weight is?
Yeah, they will all have a target which has been devised between me and the rider, but for some the target doesn't need a lot of work to get to it. So somebody might be, you know, 1 or 2 kilos heavier in the classics, and then we say, okay, for the tour it'd be better if we can get you to this point, and they will get there just from a good training block and a bit more focus around nutrition, because those, you know, heavier guys, they still need to get over the mountain passes, they still need to finish the stage in the time cut. So we still need to kind of, we have to have some parameters, but for them the big focus is on staying healthy, being able to produce the high powers when they need to, and yeah, that side of things. We have quite a wide range of weights within our squad. I think not in the Tour de France squad, but the whole squad, I think our lightest rider is around 58 kilos, and our at the bigger end, the time trial classics guys, you know, 85, 90 kilos. So it's a big difference, because they're required to have different attributes for different stages and different races. So I think it's important to have individual goals with that rider, rather than say, okay, everybody needs to be. And within that squad, we have some of our bigger, more powerful classics guys actually have the lower levels of body fat as well. They just have a much more muscle mass and much more powerful. So again, it's understanding that whole picture rather than just somebody jumping on the scales and saying, you know, this weight's good, this weight's bad. There's much more to it than that.
Yeah, this is a bit of a tangent and we might come back to it a little bit, but from a triathlon perspective, I think that this is where a lot of people, at least amateurs, go wrong, is that they look at Chris Froome or Jonas Vingegaard as like the models for why they want to lose weight, when triathlon is nothing like the tour. It's more like, as you say, the classics or time trials, and to perform well at that kind of event, actually having the muscle mass and being able to produce the big power numbers is what matters, and not the power to weight per se, which is, yeah, specific to like, yeah, those long climbs and so on. So that's an interesting point that you make there with the differences within your team.
Yeah, exactly. And understanding the terrain where certain riders are expected to perform. You know, I've worked with a few triathletes, and they've been quite weight focused, and it's like, well, what are you, what's the course like that you're expected to perform on, and things like that, and you know, is weight the key thing you should be focusing on for this? Obviously, it is important, but it's not the most important thing. I guess things like, aerodynamics and all those other things probably have a much bigger role to play in health. You know, if you're a kilo heavier, but you're healthy and you're banking all of the training that you need to, then surely that's better than being 2 kilos lighter, but missing more training, surely, just as a practical point. So, yeah.
We had an episode a month or so ago with an aerodynamics expert, and he's done some work with data from Kona, so data that was available on Strava, for example, and using that to create correlations between bike performance in Kona and watts per CDA, which you could estimate from the data, and watts per kg. There was no correlation between bike performance and watts per kg, but the correlation between watts per CDA is very strong. So I think that to a large extent, it also comes down to, it's very, very easy to measure watts per kilogram. And we often like to think that the things that we can measure matter, but they don't always matter. And the things that are hard to measure, we don't really think about because, well, they're hard to measure. So I think that that's, from a triathlon perspective, important to remember.
Yeah.
What is the psychology like in the pro peloton these days around things like weight and even body image and so on?
I mean, I don't sit in the pro peloton, so I just hear things second and third hand. But I think, obviously riders are still conscious of body image. It's a very image conscious sport. Riders are, wearing Lycra, and other riders and coaches comment on riders' appearance and things like that. So, it is part of it. Within our team, we try and manage things quite sensitively. There's a history and tradition that coaches and masseurs will comment or make comments on riders taking things from the buffet, or comment on how somebody's looking. And we try where possible to avoid, those small comments, because it can be just a small comment that somebody old school makes, because it's been made for lots of times, but then that can actually sit and play on the mind of a rider. So it's something we try and, manage quite sensitively. If there's concerns with a rider's weight or body composition that maybe a coach might have, the coach will come to me, and we will speak with the rider and see actually what's going on. Do we need to work on something here, and how can we manage that in the right way? Because I think it's easy to forget that food has a huge psychological component. How people will eat certain things when they're feeling low, or they will use food as a crutch. People will use food as a control mechanism. So it needs to be handled really sensitively, all of that side of things. We're really fortunate to have Hannah in our women's team as well. So she's responsible for our women's team riders and keeping that real healthy culture around body image and nutrition is key. Because a quote that I've used in a few presentations from one of our young riders, he said, at the end of the day, it's the fastest rider that wins. It's not the skinniest rider. And it really resonated with me, that comment. A rider might look great, but if they're not fast, it's irrelevant. So I think that's something we try and focus on a lot, and understanding again how the individual should look to perform at their best. Are they performing at their best? Are they healthy? Then body composition and body image should follow on the back of that. It shouldn't be the other thing that we're chasing.
Is it the same, basically? I mean, I'm assuming that you're doing the same things in the women's team as well, but in your discussions with Hannah, like, does it come up that, do you think that basically it's the psychology is similar in the women's team, or do you think that there are more or less concern around weight on the women's side?
So I'm not actively working with those riders in a day-to-day setting. But my impression from the outside looking in is probably that there may be more sensitivity in the women's riders. I think when riders are coming from other teams to join our system, they can often have a lot of preconceived ideas about weight and body image from coaches or people in other teams that have told them. And when we've actually looked at data and got to work with the rider, we've actually been able to, you know, put the spotlight on and say, no, actually, we think this would be a better place for you. You know, and again, understanding what kind of rider you are and what kind of terrain you need to perform on. If you're a sprinter, then it's more important that you're able to produce those high watts at the end of a hard race rather than maybe being 2 kilos lighter. But we still need to take into account that the rider needs to be able to be in those last 500 meters of a race. So we have to just find where that sweet spot is between health, performance and body composition. But yeah, I think it's really important that when the team announced it was setting up a women's team, I put my hand up and I said to Jens, our general manager, we really need a designated nutritionist for the women's team. And he was great. He was kind of saying, yeah, you know, who do you think we should get? Can you write a job specification? What do you think we need? And that's been fundamental. Hannah was actually recruited to the team before we'd signed any riders, I think. So we were able to have that system that operates. And I don't think it's always the case in all women's teams that they have that dedicated nutritionist. Quite often it's, yeah, they don't have the same provision that we have. And I think it's really important.
And I think what you say there about having that culture of not having those comments, even if they are not meant, even if they're meant as jokes and not seriously, but people, at least some people will take them seriously. So it doesn't matter if they have all the knowledge in the world from somebody like you, but if they then between one talk and the next hear three or four of those kinds of comments, then probably that's what will resonate with them more than the actual logical arguments that you lay out for like why they what works and what doesn't. So let me see here. Yeah, one question as well that I wanted to ask you is, what is your approach to supplements and other organic aids?
Yeah, I would say I'm probably fairly conservative, and I describe myself as a curious skeptic. So, as a nutritionist, I'm bombarded with companies, products, podcasts, riders telling me about other riders, you know, new products that promise this, promise that, whispers about, you know, what other teams are using in terms of supplements and ergogenic aids. And usually if something is too good to be true, you know, if it sounds too good to be true, then it typically is. So with our team, because I've come from the British English Institute of Sport system, we have a very firm stance on kind of anti-doping and contamination. So every product that we use in the team has been through like a batch testing program. We have batch testing certificates and serial numbers of every single product that's obtained by the team and that's given to our riders. Because my first thing is, you know, is it safe? Is this wonder product safe? Is it clear of contaminants? Does it contain exactly what it says? The second strand is then, does it work? Does it work? Is there enough scientific evidence? Is there good enough studies done in populations that are maybe similar to our populations? So, for example, nitrates are a supplement that gets a lot of traction and a lot of press. And there's a lot of really, really good evidence around nitrates for different types of athletes. But when you look deep into the data and you're looking at athletes with VO2 max above 70, 65, 70, then it actually shows a neutral and possibly detrimental effect on performance in endurance sports. So then it's then, well, yeah, it might work for somebody like me, you know, a recreational runner, then yeah, it probably does work. But for the elite riders in our team with, you know, very high VO2 max, then it's probably not a strategy that I would look to use. So it's about understanding all of those things. Similar to our nutrition philosophy, we start off with health. So we have supplements to support health, and you know, standard supplements that most sports nutritionists would advocate, a good quality omega-3, a probiotic, multivitamin, and we use that as an almost like an insurance policy, because our riders do a lot of travel, because they sometimes we have a chef, but other times we might not have a chef, so they're not always getting high quality nutrients when they're on the road. So we use that as almost a an insurance policy. We use prebiotic supplements as well, just to help support gut health, again in times where riders aren't consuming much fruit and vegetables and fiber by design, or by the fact that they're just not able to obtain it through the hotels and things they're staying in. And then some of the polyphenol supplements like New Zealand blackcurrant extract and tart cherry that can have influences on recovery, we use those as well. Vitamin D, there's tons
Sorry,
of evidence
what are,
about that.
Can you explain the tart cherry and the blackcurrant extract, what is the purpose of those supplements?
Yeah, so these are really concentrated amounts of a natural food. So the New Zealand blackcurrant extract is the same as eating, I think, 80 blackcurrants per capsule. So it's just the same as eating a lot of this particular type of blackcurrant. And the main reason we use it is to support the body's natural antioxidant defense, to help with immunity, and, you know, making sure inflammation is a bit more controlled in a race, and if we're on altitude camps, those kind of settings. Same with the tart cherry, so almost to reduce muscle soreness and promote recovery. So we would use those in altitude blocks and hard stage races, or the classics, times where the body's under a lot of stress, to just give the body a bit of extra support from a food derived supplement, really. So that's why we use that. There's a lot of good emerging research with the New Zealand blackcurrant extract data, but that's the main reason we use it. Vitamin D, again, yeah, vitamin D is one of the most researched supplements, and again from the bone health point of view, we find even with athletes that are living in Girona and training down there, because of sunscreen and clothing and things like that, they can still often be suboptimal in vitamin D. So we test and we adjust vitamin D throughout the year. And then buffers, like beta-alanine and sodium bicarbonate, we use those with certain riders in certain times of the year. So everything there, we would say, is safe. It's evidenced, and we would use it for certain times, for certain periods. But again, it's all done on an individual basis and with the athlete at the center. So athletes might say, yeah, I don't agree with that, I'm not going to take that supplement. And it's always got to be the athlete's choice as to what they're taking and ingesting in their body. So some athletes don't take any supplements, some take the full kind of range of supplements we use, but we always try and emphasize that the supplements we provide in the team have been tested and are safe, and riders are advised not to take any supplements outside what the team have provided.
What about caffeine? Is that something you use?
Yeah, I mean, it's a supplement and an ergogenic aid, but it's used so widely in cycling and society that, it's almost one of the ones I forget, but we do use caffeine. We try and, again, periodize it and use it strategically, because you may get a performance boost from using caffeine, but then there's usually a trade-off with sleep and recovery. So we try and get riders to think about the days in a stage race where they need to perform, and days when they need to perform but they don't need to be at their kind of 100% for that stage. It's more important that they've recovered well for the next day. So we try and get them to think in those terms. But all riders drink coffee, so we try and factor that in when we're talking about caffeine and using caffeine gum or caffeine gels and things like that.
So I think last time I checked, at least the typical research would have you take 3 to 6 milligrams per kilo body weight, usually an hour before the race. So is that similar to what you do? Of course, maybe the coffee might be a bit earlier with breakfast, but would you shoot for those numbers, and would you be more at the lower end or at the higher end? And how would you factor in maybe even caffeine gels throughout a longer stage or something like that?
Yeah, so my stance on caffeine is more isn't always better. In cycling, it's usually if, you know, 100 milligrams is good, then 300 milligrams must be really good. And it's always about trying to get the biggest, you know, performance gain, but for the lowest dose and the lowest side effects. So I would always start around the 3 milligrams per kilogram end of things, because I've had riders in the past that have gone too high, and they've had cramps, they've had you know, strange sensations in their legs, they've, you know, it's just been too much, they've not been able to concentrate, and then they've really suffered with sleep and recovery afterwards. So it's almost trying to find out what's the lowest we can get away with and get a boost, rather than what's the highest. And then the thing I always work back to is with our education with riders is caffeine stays in the system for a really long time. You know, if somebody has a caffeine gel or a caffeine chewing gum, 5 hours later, that caffeine's going to be at half its concentration. So it has a really long ergogenic window. 10, 12 hours later, it's going to be leaving the system. So it's almost, we always talk about, you know, not leaving it too late within a race to take caffeine, because depending, its peak is usually around 45 minutes when its peak action is, and then it will gradually step down. But it's not like you have an instant boost from caffeine and then it wears off 15 minutes later. It's understanding that it'll start working after around 15 minutes, it will peak around 45 to 60 minutes, and then it will gradually reduce, you know, to half concentration by 5 hours. So we try and work back where if somebody wants the peak concentration, then to take the caffeine, you know, 45, 60 minutes before the lead into that section of the race. But if somebody needs to be really active in the breakaway or in the first part of the race, they might even have caffeine pre-race, you know, caffeine chewing gum and things like that. So that's kind of our approach to it.
Yeah. And the final one that I want to ask your opinion on is ketones. Is this something that you or some of your riders are using?
Nope. We don't use it. I even, you know, I've had to do like a policy about what ketones are, the proposed mechanisms, why we don't use them, as a, like a position stand within the team. There's a few reasons, but for me as a substrate, I'm not convinced of the data that it can improve performance as an energy source. There's some small data that it may have some small effects in recovery. But again, the studies, you could pick holes in some of those studies. There's some new research coming out around its use in altitude, alongside altitude, relating to EPO production. But again, the research isn't quite strong enough for me to say, yeah, let's be using it. And the cost as well. You know, it's very expensive for what you get. But I'm astounded by, you know, how many athletes use ketones, but their carbohydrate intakes are suboptimal. We've got like 120 years of research around carbohydrate metabolism, carbohydrate performance. Riders are not getting, and triathletes as well, not optimizing their just general diet and carbohydrate, but they're using ketones like for fun. I can't understand it. So again, I'm, you know, I'm curious and I'm skeptic, and every time there's a new paper and I speak with people, but for me at the moment there's not enough evidence to recommend their use. That's my stance.
Got it. Yeah. So now maybe a hypothetical question again, but if you were working with professional triathletes instead of professional cyclists, what aspects of your work and your recommendations do you think would be different, and or what specific considerations would you have to make for the change in sport compared to cycling?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I have worked with some triathletes and some runners. And I guess the thing that would first spring to mind is the gut is probably under more stress than on a bike. You know, from the mechanical jostling of running, from swimming. So I think that side of things and the ability to take on fuel on the run, those kind of things, I would probably, and from my understanding, triathletes do seem to have more gut issues. So that's probably something I would be looking at more, whereas cyclists are able to consume quite a lot of carbohydrate on the move without too much difficulty, because they're in quite a stable position. And a little bit like when I've worked with mountain bikers, you know, the digestive system is just, you know, being bounced around a heck of a lot, and that creates big changes. And I guess as well, just the conditions that some of the elite triathlons are in, and the much more steady state, you know, in the hot weather. So I would probably think the heat preparation is really important. You're not getting kind of any cooling on descents and things, or as much cooling on descents, you know, on those long, really hot, long distance triathlons. And like we spoke about before, about weight and CDA and aerodynamics and all things like that, you know, getting to understand body composition for that an individual athlete, you know, is it the most important thing they should be focusing on, or should they be focusing on all of the other things, optimizing their nutrition around training and competition, and then body composition falling into a natural place where it needs to be, rather than chasing a optimal body composition that they've derived from somewhere. When you were talking before, it reminded me of when I worked on the track and I spoke with one of the aerodynamic experts there about weight and track performance and CDA, and they were almost saying, you know, if the rider lost 5 or 10 kilos, it might have some impact, but you know, 2 kilos, it's not going to really have any impact on those kind of numbers. They'd be the things I'd be thinking about.
Yeah. Preparing for the potential, the stress of the gut on the run, and also for the heat stress, how specifically would you do that? Is it about a gradual progression of taking on nutrition over the course of run training and training in hot conditions, or is there anything else to that?
Yeah, a mixture, and then thinking about the 24 hours before racing as well, and you know, making sure we're limiting any irritants on the gut, that we're doing some of the things that we would do before a mountain stage, you know, to really reduce high fiber food, so there's not lots of residual things left in the gut, that we're avoiding really high fat foods, red meat, spicy foods, anything that's going to cause extra stress and irritate the gut when it's going to be under a lot of heat stress. Those kind of things I would be thinking about. And then, you know, hydration, but obviously practicing some of these nutritional strategies in the heat. I think you see a lot of athletes training in Northern Europe and then they go and do a super hot marathon or a super hot triathlon, and they've not actually practiced fueling and hydrating in those situations, and it's completely different. The body will, you know, use the food and fluid completely differently, and how much can be absorbed and all of those kind of things.
Yeah, you mentioned, so is it the day before that you would focus specifically on avoiding all the irritants, or would you go for a triathlon? Of course, for a stage race, you can only really focus on like one day to the next. But if you're doing a triathlon, you're maybe, especially if you're an amateur and you're doing a few long distance triathlons a year, but let's say you're a professional even, you might do one race a month for the racing season. So you have time to, let's say, take 2 days or even 3 days if you want to, of avoiding all irritants. And what would the window be there that you would recommend?
Yeah, I would probably do 2 days as a maximum. It's quite tricky because I would only load, so I would only glycogen load for the 24 hours before competition. But if you're reducing fiber and vegetables and things like that, but then you're also reducing you're not having lots of carbohydrate in that day. Right, athletes can feel quite hungry and sluggish. So it's a bit of a balance, but I would probably be scaling back the irritant foods like 36, 48 hours before, and then 24 hours out, then I would do that glycogen loading program, similar to what we would do for like a big one-day classic or a mountain stage. So you're wanting to maximize the amount of glycogen that's loaded in the muscle, but minimize the amount of weight that's left in the gut.
All right, yeah. And then if we talk about the potential differences between professionals, so which is mainly what we've been talking about today, and amateurs in how they should approach things like nutrition, weight, etc., what are the things that you would point out there? Are there many differences, or is it more or less the same, but just scaling, obviously, for the workload in training and in races?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I think the life of a committed amateur triathlete is probably harder than the life of a professional athlete, because they have all of the other responsibilities, like, you know, a job to deal with and a family. People forget that these guys who are doing, you know, 30, 35 hours of training per week, that is their job. So I see, you know, I've worked with, you know, amateur Ironman triathletes, and they're trying to do the same type of training, but they've got all of this additional life stress as well, sleep, all of those other things. So I think you need to factor that in sometimes, that maybe the amount of training or how hard they train can sometimes be adjusted, which, yeah, you know better than I do. But yeah, focusing on those kind of things. I think as well, when time is tighter, then we spoke about it a little bit, but for some of the lower intensity sessions, using low carbohydrate or low glycogen for some of those sessions might actually enable somebody to get more bang for the buck. You know, somebody who's training 6-8 hours a week can then maybe get a slightly bigger adaptation from that lower intensity session that they're doing. But then not if they've then got to go straight to work and they've had a poor night's sleep because they've been up with their baby and all of those other things together. But I would say, you know, thinking about the biggest bang for the buck, again, staying healthy, coping with the training, not using training to as a means to lose weight, getting all of the ducks in a row, and not kind of underfueling training all of the time, because then training quality will suffer. And just being planned, being organized with cooking and all of those practical things, which are quite easy to overlook as an amateur. It's easy to buy a new shoe or new equipment rather than do some batch cooking and have a load of meals that are ready to go in your freezer and fridge, so that, you know, after training, I've got this meal ready to go.
That's all good. So when you are working with amateur athletes, are there any common trends that you see, especially in the beginning, that these are some typical, let's say, easy wins that you can get for them, or common mistakes that you would can flag to help others avoid them?
Yeah, the big thing I always see is too much over focus on the pre-race breakfast. It's like they won't have thought about nutrition apart from the pre-race breakfast, and typically they will have too much volume, too much fiber, so then they feel too full and bloated, and they've not actually had sufficient carbohydrate in the 24 hours prior. Whereas I always see breakfast, if we've loaded our muscle glycogen in the 24 hours before, then pre-race breakfast is just to top up the liver glycogen stores. So it doesn't need to be a massive, you know, huge bowl of porridge like the Three Bears would eat, and you know just eating too much at those times, and then not practicing race day nutrition, not practicing, you know, not knowing that at this leg of the bike I'm going to eat this amount, and on the run I'm going to eat this at these time points, and being able to adjust it actually if it's not working. So I think part of your training should be training the legs, but it should also be training your stomach, training the mechanics of being able to to take a gel or a drink when you're breathing quite hard. I think practicing those things is crucial, and trialing your pre-race breakfast, trialing waking up at the time you're probably going to have to wake up for a competition, and seeing how it feels to eat that breakfast. It might be fine to eat that breakfast at 8 a.m. and you're training at 10, but if you've got to eat it at 5 a.m., then it might be completely different, and you might be better having something completely different.
Yeah. For those listeners that are interested, you mentioned Tim Podlogar earlier, and we had quite a detailed discussion about what you said there with how the breakfast is, large part of its role there is restoring the liver glycogen and the muscle glycogen. It comes from the carbohydrate loading earlier on. So I'll link to that in the show notes so listeners can check that out as well. But I think we covered everything. Is there anything else on the nutrition side that you want to talk about before we move into the rapid fire questions, or are you happy with what we covered?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you can probably tell from speaking to me, my big philosophy is to try and keep things simple. I always think it's my job to think about nutrition all of the time, think about new things, think about novel things, be a point of reference. It's the bike rider's job to do the training that's prescribed and perform in races. So when I come to nutrition for riders and athletes that I'm working with, I'm trying to think of what's the best way of making it simple, easy to digest, and then they can move on from it. So it just becomes part of their practice. They shouldn't need to think about nutrition all of the time like I do. It should just be part of their day-to-day practice, so they can focus on the training and racing, which is what they get paid for. And that's kind of how I come to things.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's move on to the rapid fire questions. Take one sentence to answer each of these. And the first one is, what is your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
So I'll give you two. I'll give you a textbook, which is Sports Nutrition by Gleason and Eukendrup. That's a real big volume textbook. And a book I've just read by Crawley called Out of Thin Air, and it's about runners in Ethiopia, and it's more around the sociology and how they live and their beliefs. Two different books.
Yeah, I had Crawley on as a guest on this podcast talking about that as well, and that was really fascinating. I read that book and really liked it. What's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
I think for me it's just to get it done, get it done early, get it out of the way. I think if you leave things, whether that training or some work that you don't want to do to later in the day, it doesn't happen. And if it does happen, it's of poor quality. If you just get out, get it done, then yeah, that helps me athletically and professionally.
And who is somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
There's a lot of people within Uno X. Our head coach, Espen Ashgold, is a real good guy. He questions things, he challenges perceptions and reads a lot, and he's somebody who inspires me to think and look at things differently all of the time. So he's a good guy. He's somebody who should get on this program.
I'll do that. I'll write down his name and try to reach out to him. And finally, James, where do you? I know actually that's how we connected on Twitter. You've been posting some really interesting stuff, especially during the tour. I was following you posting some nutrition tidbits from your team's work. Well, is Twitter? Do you have Instagram or other places where people can follow you and your work?
Yeah, Twitter's probably the place I use mostly for professional. Seeing what's going on and sharing insights, that's probably the best place. I think my handle is James EP Moran. I think that's, but I'm not massively active on social media. I use it more as a research tool rather than a promotion tool.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you. Hope to do it again another time, and good luck to Uno X for the rest of the season.
Thank you. And thanks for the conversation. It's good fun.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, including links to related episodes. I will also link to the Nutrition Category Archive, which is a page where you can find all past episodes of the podcast that have been tagged as nutrition. So if this is a topic that you want to learn more about, then don't forget to look for past episodes that you might not have listened to yet by going to that particular archive. And I might remind everybody that on the episode show notes page on scientifictriathlon.com. You can also use this kind of archiving function or category function, I should say, so that you can click through to see a list of episodes of a particular category, and that way you can filter through content that you want to learn more about. Next Monday, I interview Austrian national team cycling coach Stefan Selkner in a classic training talk format, so stay tuned for that. And for the next little while, I will be promoting the Mallorca training camp here at the end of the episodes. And I really do hope to see a lot of podcast listeners there in April. We always have an amazing time, superb training, and a really great camaraderie amongst the group, with athletes coming in from all around the world, getting to know each other, sharing the great cycling roads and the great views. And some of our past camps have actually resulted in long-lasting friendships between people that didn't know each other before the camp. So that's always really nice to see. Another great thing that we have going for our camp is that we do it in collaboration with Frank and Kajsa Jakobsen. And Frank is a coach who has worked with athletes like Craig Alexander. You can actually listen to Frank on multiple past appearances on That Triathlon Show. Just search for his name on scientifictriathlon.com. But his expertise and experience is definitely something to tap into with the resume that he has. And if you're interested, you can check out the webpage for the camp on scientifictriathlon.com and follow the instructions there to register, or email me directly on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for electrolytes and fueling products, I would highly recommend trying them out. You can use their free fuel and hydration planner, or even a free video consultation with the team to prepare your race strategy. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS23. And thank you to Form, that you can find on formswim.com/TTS. Improve your swim training with real-time metrics like pace, stroke rate, and heart rate, and advanced post-swim analysis. And use the code TTS15 to get 15% off the Form Smart Swim Goggles. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.